Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, March 13th through Saturday, the 15th, feature guest conductor Manfred Honeck, along with a quartet of vocal soloists Joelle Harvey, soprano, mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnson-Cano, Andrew Haji, tenor, and baritone Joshua Hopkins, along with the Chicago Symphony Chorus guest director Donald McNally. The program includes Larghetto for Orchestra by James McMillan, Beethoven's Symphony No. 1, and after intermission, Haydn's Mass in C Major, Mass in Time of War. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on James McMillan's Larghetto for Orchestra, a work lasting about 13 minutes. This music began as Miserere, a choral setting of portions of Psalm 51. The Scottish composer James McMillan has written a great deal of sacred choral music throughout his career, beginning at the age of 17 with a Missa Brevis for four unaccompanied voices. His catalog has grown to include such large-scale monuments as the Stabat Mater and Seven Last Words from the Cross, a modern-day bookend to Haydn's celebrated work of 1796, the same year he composed the Mass that concludes this week's concert. But that is only one side of Macmillan's musical makeup, and his compositions reflect not only his Catholicism, but elements of Scottish life and folk music. He's regularly played in Scottish folk bands, and the Scottish snap rhythm is a constant in his work, as well as his commitment to innovation alongside a deep understanding of the past. I respect tradition in many forms, he's written, whether cultural, political, or historical, and in keeping up a continuous, delicate scrutiny of old forms, ancient traditions, enduring beliefs, and lasting values, one is strengthened in one's constant, restless search for new avenues of expression. The Larghetto, performed at these concerts, is a recent orchestral version of the Miserere McMillan wrote in 2009. Although Miserere is keenly attentive to the meaning of the Latin text, both at the word-by-word level and as a single long-breathed span, from the repentance of the opening to the vision of hope at the end, his orchestral version transforms the Miserere into a distinct composition, even though it is in effect the same music. The original evocation of Gregorian chant, the atmosphere of music echoing in a vast cathedral, and the association with Ash Wednesday are all translated into a web of pure instrumental sound, a wordless chorus of universal musical ideas. The Larghetto unfolds as a single span of music. It is through-composed, McMillan has written, but structured in a series of interlocking sections and bound together by a number of recurring motifs. The orchestral version of Miserere was commissioned by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra in honor of the 10th anniversary of its music director, Manfred Honeck, in 2017. The text of the Miserere begins, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy great goodness." Notes by Philip Pusher on James McMillan's Larghetto for Orchestra. And now on to Beethoven's Symphony No. 1, a work lasting about 25 minutes. This is a young man's music. As the first symphony by the greatest symphonist who ever lived, one might expect clues of the daring and novelty to come, since it was written at the turn of the century and premiered in Vienna, the great musical capital, in 1800. One might assume that it is with this work that Beethoven opened a new era in music. But, in fact, this symphony belongs to the 18th, not the 19th century. It honors the tradition of Mozart, dead less than a decade, and Haydn, who had given Beethoven enough lessons to know that his student would soon set out on his own. The First Symphony is a conservative work by the least conservative of composers. Just 2 years later, Beethoven proudly announced that he would follow a new path. Alexander Thayer, who wrote the first significant book on Beethoven, saw 1800 as a turning point in the composer's career. It is the year in which, cutting loose from the pianoforte, he asserted his claims to a position with Mozart and the still living and productive Haydn in the higher forms of chamber and orchestral compositions, the quartet and the symphony. It was a bold step for a young composer, Beethoven wasn't yet 30, to write his first symphony when Haydn's final work in the form was just 5 years old and Mozart's Jupiter a scant 12. But this was perhaps the best and certainly the riskiest way for Beethoven to stake his claim to their territory. Beethoven had moved to Vienna in 1792, the year after Mozart died, and in the famous words of Count Waldstein, he was to receive Mozart's spirit from Haydn's hands. Beethoven learned plenty from the example of Haydn's music, but the actual lessons he had with the master didn't go well, and Beethoven quickly understood that if he was to play a role in this great Viennese tradition, he would have to carve out a place for himself, all by himself. Beethoven began to sketch a symphony in C major in 1795, and he was still struggling with it during a concert tour to Prague and Berlin the following year. But Beethoven apparently wasn't ready to reckon with this great form yet, and he turned his attention primarily to the piano sonata, which became the vehicle for his most advanced ideas. In 1799, the year he composed one of his real watershed works, the Pathetik Sonata, Beethoven decisively returned to the idea of writing a symphony. The C major symphony he finished early in 1800 is the first of eight he would compose in 13 years. On April 2, 1800, Beethoven held a concert in Vienna's Burgtheater, the first he would give for his own benefit in this opinionated and difficult music center. In a gesture of savvy public relations, he included a symphony by Mozart and two numbers from Haydn's Creation on the program to set the scene for his own music, some of it new, like the septet that quickly became one of his most popular pieces, and this first symphony. Sadly, inexplicably, the Viennese critics ignored the performance, but the Leipzig correspondent called it truly the most interesting concert in a long time. Beethoven's first symphony is scored for the orchestra of Haydn and Mozart, including the clarinets that weren't yet a standard feature, and written in the conventional four-movement form he would soon transform. Although it's a surprisingly cautious work from a bold and sometimes brazen composer, it's neither faceless nor unaccomplished, and the critics of the time found it neither timid nor derivative. Beethoven begins slyly with the kind of cadences that normally end a work, stated in the wrong key, or rather searching for the right key. Haydn had used a similar trick in his string quartet, but never to open a symphony. Beethoven liked the effect so much that he did something comparable in his next work, The Creatures of Prometheus. The entire movement sparkles with genuine energy and is particularly colored by the brilliant and inventive writing for winds. One critic complained that it sounded more like a wind band than an orchestra. The slow movement is charming and graceful. It is slight, as sometimes suggested only by the composer's own later standards. Beethoven calls the next movement a minuet, but both his tempo, allegro molto e vivace, and a very swift metronome marking argue that this is really the first of his true symphonic scherzos. Haydn had begun to write third movement scherzos in his string quartets, but he didn't transfer that crucial development into his symphonies. The finale, with its humorous, slow introduction, is as playful and spirited as anything in Haydn. It is not yet the heroic or the revolutionary Beethoven, but it proves brilliantly that the student had learned his teacher's lessons well. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Beethoven's Symphony No. 1. And now on to Haydn's Mass in C Major, Mass in Time of War. The work lasts about 41 minutes. It was Haydn himself who wrote Missa in Tempore Belli, Mass in Time of War, at the top of the manuscript of his new sacred work. This unusual gesture, in an age when mass settings were not given dramatic titles, suggests that Haydn recognized that these years, the last ones of his life, were not ordinary times. Coming long before people followed the news obsessively, allowing political conflicts and global uncertainty to overwhelm their daily lives, Haydn's title is remarkable. In 1796, Haydn was the most popular composer alive. He had lost his good friend, valued colleague, and only real competition, Wolfgang Mozart, 4 years earlier. Young Ludwig van Beethoven, something of an upstart whose Vienna debut the previous year had made everyone sit up and listen, would not complete his first symphony, the one performed earlier on this program, for another 4 years. Haydn had recently returned to Vienna from his second residency in London, where he was treated like royalty, and each of the 12 new symphonies he unveiled there was a public triumph. The premiere of the last of them, now known as the No. 104, nicknamed London, in May 1795, was probably the single greatest success of Haydn's career. He had now become that rarest of 18th-century commodities, an international celebrity. What Haydn did next is something no one could have imagined. After spending 4 decades of his life perfecting and transforming the classical symphony, in the process writing more than 100 works, including many that are still recognized as landmarks in the form, and earning the sobriquet Father of the Symphony, he stopped writing symphonies altogether and turned his attention and his scrupulously honed talents, then at their peak, to the church mass. The last chapter of Haydn's life, as consequential as it was unexpected, is devoted to vocal music, crowned by 6 masses and 2 oratorios, the Creation and the Seasons. In a long career dominated by instrumental music, symphonies, string quartets, and piano sonatas, Haydn now transferred all that he had learned and all the skills he had painstakingly mastered to a new realm. Although he still wrote 8 string quartets and a single concerto for trumpet in the final dozen years of his life, there were no more symphonies or piano sonatas, even though he was asked to write both. Between 1796 and 1802, Haydn composed 6 masses that were at least in part written as a commission at the Eisenstadt court for the Esterházy family, his longtime patrons, and intended to celebrate the name day of the resident princess Maria Hermengilde. They are among the most significant compositions of his career. Mozart, by comparison, left only 2 major sacred works, the C minor Mass and the Requiem, both in fragmentary states. The first 2 masses were both composed in 1796, and there is still uncertainty about the order in which they were performed. Like the 5 other masses from this period, the one in C major unites the rigors of abstract music and large-scale symphonic form with the expressive demands of setting a text to music. Everything that audiences had come to expect from the mature Haydn, an economy of gesture, a sure grasp of symphonic development, flawless technical mastery at the note-to-note level, disarmingly simple yet unforgettable melodic lines, a pristine and transparent instrumentation is here in crystallized form. There is also the natural idiomatic and sometimes highly virtuosic writing for voices that we today, largely unfamiliar with Haydn's earlier career writing for the opera house, may not expect. Despite its forbidding subtitle, the C major Mass is suffused with the optimism of strength and devotion. As Georg August Reisinger, Haydn's first biographer, wrote in 1810, "Indeed, his faith was never of the bleak, incessantly penitential kind, but cheerful, reconciled, and trusting, and it was in this spirit that he composed his sacred works, too." The Mass opens calmly and with the hint of a turn from C major toward minor, even ominously. But the bulk of the Kyrie is an ebullient allegro moderato, crowned by the solo soprano's soaring flights. The blueprint, not surprisingly, from the symphonic master is sonata form. The Gloria begins and ends as a supremely confident vivace surrounding an arioso for the bass soloist, introduced by a flowing melody in the cello and later joined by the flute at Qui tollis peccata mundi, who takes away the sins of the world. The Credo is a brilliant declaration of faith with big, energetic choral fugues at the beginning and at the end. The slow music at the heart of the movement, begun by the solo quartet at Et Incarnatus Est and erupting finally with Et Resurrexit, is the work of a master dramatist. The sudden drop at Mortuorum is stunning. The Sanctus begins slowly, deliberately, like stately music from an earlier era. It moves forward over a walking bass line, a common feature in Baroque music, before it explodes in music of an economy and brilliance that ideally sets off the following Benedictus, an expansive Siciliana for the four soloists. As Haydn composed the new mass, Napoleon was threatening Vienna and Austria's Erblande territory from Italy, news that his first audience could not have put out of their mind when the calm, chordal opening of the Agnus Dei is disturbed by the rumblings of the timpani like the sounds of distant strife. It is an effect that Beethoven echoes in his Missa Solemnis two decades later. The placid F major opening is then repeated, now in a troubled C minor, before blazing fanfares push the music toward its triumphant Dona Nobis Pacem, giving the obligatory plea of Grant Us Peace special currency, a message of urgency in 1796, and one of universal gravity in our world today. After Haydn's death, the Mass was sometimes billed as the Paukenmesse, the kettle drum Mass, after the theatrical timpani cameo near the end, as if to purify the sacred score of local political connotations. But Haydn put his title there not just to give it the immediacy of a daily headline. It's said that one of the Napoleonic army's cannonballs fell in his Vienna courtyard, but because he knew that the foreboding of 1796 would long outlive him. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Haydn's Mass in Time of War. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.